A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Hello there, Herman and Corin. We've talked in recent episodes about apartment living and some of the things we talked about on a construction level for like better noise insulation. And I'd love to talk today about the interpersonal aspect of this thing when people are living together in tight spaces and urban spaces, especially given the reality of, you know, an increasingly urbanized world and a world geography like Israel where people are crowding into these pretty small spaces, and the extraordinarily high cost of real estate means that even what might be considered wealthy people in other countries are often forced here into smaller living arrangements, and what you might consider very generously spaced apartments are the preserve of like the ultra wealthy, which is not most people, needless to say. And when you're living in these spaces, so I grew up in a detached home in Ireland. And that's kind of, I guess, with the exception of people who live in the inner city, kind of the default living arrangement. You might have terraced houses in, you know, the kind of intermediate suburbs that some friends lived in. But it's not the norm that unless you're a student or for some reason like living in the city center, which is not most people, that you're going to live in a detached house. In Israel, it's very, very different. The default living arrangement is apartment based. And when I moved here, my first summer, I recall living in like two, if not three sublets. And then between now and then, which has been a 10-year stretch, a long time, I've lived in more apartments than I would like. And as I explained, mostly due to things that I think are just reflective of the terrible state of the rental market and our rental law here. I've never been late on rent. I've always paid my rent on time. I've always, you know, my wife and I have always taken care of wherever we lived. We've often repaired things for our landlords. And in return, we get treated like, I don't want to say, you know, not very nicely. Our previous tenancy came to an end when our landlord decided to gift the apartment to a daughter. And that was, I'm sure, great for the daughter, but it meant that we needed to find a new place to live and had to, you know, where was our home? What, the space that was our home for 2-3 years, however long we were there, suddenly you've got like a month or 2 months to just pack up and leave. And likewise in our current place, we had a leak issue that the landlord just kind of lashed out at us for, cancelled our contract, and now we have another move in the summer. So this has been a pretty grim 10 years, I would say, of living in rentals. And I would say because of the battle scars from that, I've kind of adopted a pretty callous approach to neighborly relations. And I'm not talking about being unpleasant to neighbors so much as that I feel like I never really want to invest in relationships with neighbors, because either you're going to really like your neighbors and then one day your tenancy ends and you're like, what was the point of that relationship? Or like, you know, I don't want to say heartbreaking, but might be really jarring and disappointing. And then sometimes, like we talked about neighbors playing music, you do want to have those chats that I'm terrible at and hate doing, where you knock on someone's door and say, hey, it's like, you know, 1 a.m. and we have work tomorrow. Would you mind turning down the music? So I guess I always feel if you do form a really friendly relation with neighbors and not being very good at either confrontation nor living in apartment spaces, that it's going to be like awkward and hard to have those more, you know, challenging conversations. And that I think is just purely on me, but it's just another part of the reason. So I think that, you know, we talked about how much more evolved the rental market and the regulation of the rental market is in places like Germany, where my wife is building a project. And I guess rather than dwell upon how terrible our rental market is in Israel, which I genuinely think it is a unregulated swamp, and anyone who tells you otherwise it might tell you about the laws that have been brought in and aren't applied. Probably doesn't themselves rent. I would tell you that it's an unregulated and unpleasant swamp. But some countries, rather than dwell on that, we can look at the countries that have done this better. And my wife, as an architect, is I think architects are often misunderstood as just the people who, you know, make nice renderings and think of nice buildings, but they actually take a much more holistic view of space use and development. And I think if my wife were sending this prompt, Hannah, she would say, she would probably look at it from the perspective that not only is this damaging to people with the kind of rental churn we're talking about here, it's actually destructive to local communities. Because in our episodes about preparedness and the kind of crazy and unique security situation we've had in Israel with the repetitive wars with Iran, we mentioned how knowing your neighbors is, even if you're not looking to form a great social, you know, network in your building, which I think most people probably aren't, even in rental markets with better tenant protections. You just want to know who the people living there are, maybe for selfish reasons, maybe for mutual selfishness. You want to, you know, if there's someone in the building with vulnerability, they're elderly, they might, or, you know, people in the building know that I'm a tech guy and I have a bunch of Ethernet ports, and someone in a WhatsApp group says, hey, my internet router is broken. Can anyone know, you know, to come down? And I'd be more than happy to, help someone out and give them some spare parts even. So I think there's like an ecosystem that can totally emerge in a building that it's actually mutually beneficial. And it shouldn't be that buildings are dominated by this kind of adversarial environment, or one in which, as in my case, and maybe this is going on more than I realize, people just aren't bothering to invest in being friendly and nice and getting to know their neighbors, because everyone is working from the premise that these are people that'll kind of pop in and pop out of my life in a couple of years. The other thing that I think about, and this is a separate point, but I think tangentially important, is that I feel like there's something jarring about the, when you have apartments that are turned into Airbnbs, and this is something that I've seen happen so many times, and I suspect part of the reason that our landlord once decided to end our tenancy without reason after the leak, is they eye up the revenue stream from Airbnb and determine that that's more lucrative than renting it out to people. And that, I think, for everyone else in the building, I think not only is that terrible to just, you know, end tenancies for those kind of reasons, but it kind of degrades the building for everyone else, because suddenly, and I've seen this happen in buildings I've lived in, you've got this random kind of cast of people who like drift in and drift out. You see them in the elevators one day, the next day it's somebody else, and then you suss that, wait, there's an Airbnb beneath me. So these are things where regulations around use and discourse around Airbnb, which has become a thing in Israel recently, actually begins to click with me, because you're like, wait, it's not the people object to Airbnb and think that, you know, allowing people to run their own businesses is, Airbnb is kind of broken, which I probably tend to agree with. It's that this is turning a rental into a commercial operation. And the landlord might say, wait, but, you know, renting it out to tenants is business for me. So what's different about Airbnb? Anyway, these are all the dynamics I'd like to pull upon. And I'd love to know, Herman and Corn, I've given you my one data point, but I'd love to know about what's been observed in maybe larger scale data sets, especially in places like, you know, Germany, Singapore, where Hong Kong, where people have rental markets have grown up with a round-based understanding that there is stronger tenant protection law, and you mightn't have that same set of incentives that push people away from forming wholesome communities within a building. And that is a word that you use, or I've heard you use in previous episodes, talking about a building as an ecosystem. And I have to say, it's a spot on word, because it really is that. You have tenants, you might have businesses, you have building maintenance. And then ideally, this isn't an ecosystem of people who are at each other's throats. And, you know, people don't need to love one another, but it has to be at least a baseline of mutual respect, knowing who the other people are, and functionality, and not just a zoo. So Herman and Corn, let's talk about it in today's episode of My Word Prompts.
Daniel sent us this one, and it's a big one. He's been living in Israel for a decade now, and he's moved more times than he can count, almost always not by choice. Landlords gifting apartments to daughters, landlords cancelling contracts after leak disputes, and meanwhile the rental law just sits there like a decorative houseplant. His core question is, when you're constantly being uprooted, why bother investing in neighborly relationships at all? And he wants to know what happens in countries where tenants actually have some security. What does community look like when people aren't always one landlord's whim away from a moving truck?
He's right to point to Germany and Singapore as places where the whole dynamic shifts. But before we get there, quick note. Today's episode is being scripted by DeepSeek V4 Pro, so if anything sounds unusually coherent, that's why.
Now, Daniel's experience is genuinely grim. A decade of paying rent on time, fixing things for landlords, being a model tenant, and still getting treated like a temporary inconvenience. That's not just bad luck. That's a system designed to produce exactly that outcome.
And the thing that jumped out at me from his prompt was the word he used, ecosystem. He's exactly right. A residential building is an ecosystem, and the rental market structure determines whether that ecosystem is healthy or basically a desert where nothing takes root. Let's start with Israel because his experience is the data point we have. Israel's rental market is essentially unregulated in ways that would shock someone from Berlin or Vienna. The standard lease is 12 months. After that, the landlord can terminate for almost any reason or no reason at all, with just 60 or 90 days notice. There's no rent control to speak of. Rent increases are whatever the market will bear. And the enforcement of what few protections exist is practically non-existent.
That 12-month lease cycle is the engine of everything else. If you know you might be out in a year, why would you knock on the neighbor's door and introduce yourself? Why would you join the building committee? Why would you care about the long-term maintenance of the common areas? You're in survival mode. Get in. Keep your head down. Don't make waves. Hope the landlord renews.
There's actually research on this. A study from the Urban Institute looked at residential mobility and social capital. They found that neighborhoods with higher rental turnover have measurably lower levels of what they call neighborhood social cohesion. People are less likely to know their neighbors' names, less likely to exchange favors, less likely to intervene if they see something wrong. It's not that renters are inherently less community-minded. It's that the structure disincentivizes investment.
Daniel mentioned something really specific that I think a lot of people feel but don't articulate. He said if you do form a friendly relationship with neighbors, it makes those difficult conversations harder. Asking someone to turn down music at 1 in the morning is awkward enough with a stranger. But if you've had them over for coffee, now there's emotional friction, so he preemptively avoids the friendship to preserve the ability to complain, which is a totally rational calculus in a dysfunctional system.
It's rational and it's tragic, because what he's describing is essentially a low-trust equilibrium. Everyone in the building is a stranger, so everyone acts like strangers, which reinforces the dynamic. And the landlord turnover machine just keeps churning. Now let's contrast that with Germany because the difference is structural and it's massive. In Germany, the default lease is indefinite, not 12 months. A landlord cannot simply decide not to renew. They can only terminate for specific, legally defined reasons. The big three are, 1, the tenant has significantly breached the contract, like not paying rent for months. 2, the landlord needs the apartment for themselves or immediate family, what's called Eigenbedarf. And even that has to be proven, it's not just a casual claim. 3, the landlord wants to demolish or substantially renovate and can't reasonably do it with the tenant in place. That's it. You can't just say, my daughter wants the apartment, unless you can demonstrate genuine hardship.
That changes everything psychologically. If you know you can stay for 10 years, 20 years, suddenly it's worth painting the walls a color you actually like. It's worth getting to know the family across the hall. It's worth joining the building's decision-making processes, which in Germany are formalized through tenant associations.
The rent control framework reinforces this. Germany has what's called the Mietpreisbremse, the rental price break. In designated tight housing markets, new rental contracts can't exceed the local comparative rent by more than 10%. And even for existing contracts, rent increases are capped at 20% over 3 years, or 15% in tight markets. So you're not just securing your tenure, you're also protected from being priced out.
What's the local comparative rent based on?
It's the Mietspiegel, the rent index. It's a database compiled by municipalities, often in collaboration with landlord and tenant associations. It reflects actual rents paid for comparable apartments in the area, adjusted for size, location, amenities, and condition. It's publicly available. so when you sign a lease, you can look up whether the rent being asked is within the legal range. Transparency builds trust.
Compare that to Israel, where you're basically guessing what the market rate is based on a handful of listings on Yad2, and the landlord can ask for whatever they want. There's no index, no transparency, no break.
Here's where it gets interesting for Daniel's ecosystem point. In Germany, because tenants are stable, they form Mieterbeirat, tenant advisory councils. These are elected bodies that represent tenant interests to the landlord or property management. They have actual legal standing. They can negotiate on maintenance, on heating costs, on building improvements. They're not just a suggestion box, they're a recognized part of the building's governance.
The building becomes a polity, a small democracy, which means you have to know your neighbors, you have to talk to them, you have to cooperate. The system forces community, or at least creates the conditions where community is rational.
It's not forced in a coercive sense, it's that the incentives align. If you're going to be there for years, and if collective action can actually improve your living conditions, then getting involved stops being a sucker's game. It becomes self-interest, properly understood.
Daniel mentioned his wife Hannah, who's an architect, and he said she would probably frame this as not just damaging to individuals, but destructive to local communities. She's right, and the German model demonstrates that. When tenants are transient, the building is just a container for sleeping. When tenants are stable, the building becomes a node in a neighborhood network. The bakery on the corner has regular customers. The school knows the families. The elderly neighbor who needs help has someone to call.
There's a concept in urban planning literature called residential stability and neighborhood social organization. Sampson and colleagues did foundational work on this. They found that residential stability is one of the strongest predictors of collective efficacy, which is the willingness of neighbors to intervene for the common good. Things like, will someone stop kids from spray painting a wall? Will someone check on an elderly neighbor during a heat wave? Those aren't just nice-to-haves. They correlate with lower crime rates, better health outcomes, even higher property values over time.
Daniel's point about the security situation in Israel makes this even starker. He's lived through multiple rounds of conflict with Iran. In those moments, knowing your neighbors isn't a social nicety. It's a survival mechanism. Who has a safe room? Who needs help getting to shelter? Who has medical training? If your building is a revolving door of strangers, you don't know any of that.
The preparedness angle is huge. I practiced pediatrics in Israel for years. I saw families in apartment buildings during rocket attacks. The buildings where neighbors knew each other, where there was a WhatsApp group, where someone had taken the time to map out who needed assistance, those buildings functioned. The buildings where everyone was anonymous, people were scared and isolated. Same physical infrastructure, totally different outcomes.
We've established that tenant protections create stability, and stability enables community. But let's talk about the flip side. Critics of strong tenant protections argue that rent control and eviction restrictions reduce the supply of rental housing. Landlords exit the market. Apartments get converted to condos. New construction stalls. Is there evidence for that?
It's contested, and it depends heavily on the design of the regulations. The Econ 101 model says rent control reduces supply, and there are cases where poorly designed rent control has done exactly that. San Francisco and New York have studies showing that strict rent control led landlords to convert rental units to owner-occupied housing or to let buildings deteriorate. But Germany's system is different in two crucial ways. First, the Mietpreisbremse only applies to new contracts in tight markets. Existing tenants aren't locked into below-market rents forever. Second, Germany has invested massively in new housing construction. The government subsidizes social housing through low-interest loans and direct grants. In 2022, the German government committed to building 400,000 new apartments per year, with 100,000 of those being social housing.
400,000 a year is serious ambition. Did they hit that?
They didn't. They fell short, partly due to rising construction costs and interest rates. But the commitment signals something important. Strong tenant protections don't exist in a vacuum. They're part of a broader housing policy that treats housing as a social good, not just a financial asset.
That's the philosophical divide, isn't it? Is housing a right or an investment vehicle? Israel, and to a large extent the United States, have leaned hard into the investment vehicle model. Germany, Austria, Singapore, they lean toward the social good model, and the outcomes are dramatically different.
Let's talk about Singapore, because it's the most extreme version of the social good model, and it produces some fascinating community dynamics. About 80% of Singapore's population lives in HDB flats. HDB stands for Housing and Development Board. These are government-built and government-subsidized apartments that residents purchase on 99-year leases. It's not rental, it's ownership, but it's heavily managed ownership. And the ethnic integration policy is remarkable. The government mandates racial quotas in every HDB block and neighborhood to prevent ethnic enclaves from forming. You can't sell your flat to someone of a certain ethnicity if that ethnicity's quota in the block is already full.
That's a level of social engineering that would be unthinkable in most Western countries, mandating who your neighbors can be based on ethnicity.
It's deeply illiberal by Western standards, and it raises real ethical questions. But the stated goal is racial harmony and integration, and on that metric, it's been remarkably successful. Singapore went from race riots in the 1960s to a society where people of Chinese, Malay, and Indian backgrounds live side by side and interact daily. The HDB blocks have common spaces, void decks on the ground floor where community events happen, markets and food courts integrated into the neighborhoods. It's not just housing, it's a deliberate design for social cohesion.
The stability is baked in because people own their flats. They're not getting evicted on a landlord's whim. They have every incentive to invest in the community because they're going to be there for decades, and their property value depends on the neighborhood being well-maintained and desirable.
There's a formal structure for community governance. Every HDB estate has a residence committee, an RC. These are volunteer organizations recognized by the government. They organize events, they run neighborhood watch programs, they mediate disputes. They have a small budget from the government. So again, the ecosystem Daniel was talking about, it's not left to chance. It's architected.
Daniel mentioned that architects are often misunderstood as just making pretty renderings, but they actually take a holistic view of space use. Singapore is the ultimate example of that. The entire city-state was planned with social outcomes in mind. The housing isn't just shelter. It's infrastructure for community.
The results show up in the data. Singapore consistently ranks near the top globally in measures of public safety, social cohesion, and resident satisfaction. In a 2021 survey by the HDB, over 90% of residents reported being satisfied with their living environment. Over 80% said they had good relationships with their neighbors. Those are extraordinary numbers for a dense urban environment.
Now, Daniel also raised the Airbnb issue, and I want to spend some time on that because it's a different but related problem. He described buildings where apartments get converted to short-term rentals, and suddenly you've got a rotating cast of strangers in the elevator. It degrades the building for everyone else. And he noted that his own landlord may have terminated a tenancy to switch to Airbnb because the revenue is higher.
This is a global phenomenon, and Israel has been grappling with it. In 2018, Israel introduced regulations on short-term rentals. The key provision was that anyone renting out their entire apartment for more than 90 days a year needed to register as a business and pay VAT of 17%. But enforcement has been spotty. And in practice, many Airbnb operators simply ignore the rules or structure their operations to stay under the threshold.
The 90-day threshold is interesting because it's trying to draw a line between someone occasionally renting out their spare room, which is the original Airbnb pitch, and someone running an unlicensed hotel. But the enforcement problem means that line is basically theoretical.
The impact on buildings is real. There was a study from Barcelona that looked at the effect of Airbnb density on residential communities. They found that in buildings with high concentrations of short-term rentals, long-term residents reported higher levels of noise complaints, security concerns, and feelings of alienation. The transient population doesn't have a stake in the building. They don't care about the building committee. They don't attend meetings. They don't know the quiet hours. And they're on vacation, so they're often making noise at hours when residents are trying to sleep.
Daniel's point about the landlord saying, wait, renting to tenants is also a business, so what's the difference, is worth engaging with. The difference is externalities. When you rent to a long-term tenant, that tenant becomes part of the building ecosystem. They have a stake in the common areas. They might join the committee. They at least have an incentive to maintain decent relationships with neighbors because they'll see them every day. When you run an Airbnb, you're externalizing costs onto everyone else in the building. The noise, the wear and tear on common areas, the security concerns, all of that is borne by the permanent residents, while the revenue goes to the landlord.
This is classic economics of externalities. The landlord captures the benefit of higher short-term rental income. The costs are diffused across all the other residents. And the market doesn't correct for this on its own because the residents don't have a mechanism to charge the landlord for the nuisance. That's where regulation is supposed to step in.
Some cities have stepped in aggressively. Barcelona essentially banned new short-term rental licenses in the city center. New York City has strict rules requiring the host to be present during the stay for rentals under 30 days. Paris has a registration system and fines for non-compliance. The common thread is that these cities recognize that unlimited short-term rentals were hollowing out residential neighborhoods.
Amsterdam is another interesting case. They implemented a 60-day annual cap on whole home rentals, and they require hosts to register each booking with the city. They also gave neighbors a hotline to report nuisance from short-term rentals. The compliance rate went up significantly once neighbors had a direct channel to complain.
The ecosystem fights back. When residents are empowered to protect their building's character, they do. But that requires a baseline of, 1, legal protections, and 2, residents who feel invested enough to use them. Which brings us back to Daniel's original problem. If you're a tenant on a 12-month lease with no security, are you going to be the one who calls the hotline and reports the Airbnb downstairs? You'll just be annoyed quietly and then move out.
The passivity is a rational response to powerlessness. And that's what's so corrosive about Israel's rental market. It doesn't just make individual tenants miserable. It degrades the social fabric building by building, block by block. People stop caring because caring has no payoff.
Let's talk about Austria for a moment, because Vienna is often held up as the gold standard of urban housing. What's the structure there?
Vienna is remarkable. About 60% of the city's population lives in social housing of some form. The city owns about 220,000 apartments directly, and another 200,000 are owned by limited profit housing associations. These aren't just for the poor. Social housing in Vienna is available to a broad swath of the middle class. The income cap for eligibility is quite high. Something like a household income of around 50,000 euros after deductions can still qualify.
It's not stigmatized. It's not the projects. It's just how people live.
Because the city is the landlord, there's no profit motive to evict tenants or jack up rents. Rents are cost-based. They cover maintenance, administration, and debt service on construction loans. The average rent in a Vienna municipal apartment is around 7 or 8 euros per square meter. Compare that to Berlin, which is around 12 to 15 on the private market, or Tel Aviv, which is often 25 to 30 shekels per square meter, roughly 6 to 8 euros, but for much smaller spaces and lower quality.
The stability effects.
Tenants in Vienna's social housing have essentially indefinite tenure. They can pass apartments down to their children in some cases, so you have multi-generational communities in these buildings. People know each other for decades. The building committee isn't just a governance structure, it's a social institution, and the architecture reflects this. The famous Gemeindebauten, the municipal housing complexes, were designed with courtyards, communal laundry rooms, kindergartens, libraries. They were built to be communities, not just apartment blocks.
Daniel mentioned his wife, Hannah, is working on a project in Germany. I wonder if she's seeing some of this philosophy in action. The idea that a building is not just a stack of units, but a designed social environment.
German architecture and urban planning have grappled with this explicitly since the post-war period. There's a whole tradition of thinking about Wohnumfeld, the living environment, as something that needs to be intentionally designed. Not just the apartment, but the spaces between apartments. The hallways, the courtyards, the connections to the street. If you design those well, social interaction happens naturally. If you design them poorly, you get anonymous corridors that people hurry through without making eye contact.
That's a point worth underlining. Even with strong tenant protections, the physical design matters. You can have indefinite leases in a building that's all narrow hallways and no common spaces, and you'll still get less community than you would in a well-designed building with moderate turnover. It's not just policy, it's also architecture.
There's a famous study by Festinger, Schachter, and Back from 1950 looking at a student housing complex at MIT. They found that the strongest predictor of friendship formation was physical proximity and the layout of the building. People whose apartments faced the stairwell made more friends because they encountered more people. People at the end of long corridors were isolated. The architecture shaped the social network.
If we're synthesizing this for Daniel, the picture looks something like this. Strong tenant protections create stability. Stability creates the conditions for community investment, but you also need physical design that facilitates interaction. And you need formal structures, tenant councils, building committees, WhatsApp groups, that give residents agency. When all of those pieces are in place, you get the ecosystem he's talking about. When any of them is missing, the whole thing degrades.
The degradation is not neutral. It's actively harmful. We talked about collective efficacy earlier. There's also research on the health effects of social isolation in urban environments. A meta-analysis by Holt Lundstad and colleagues found that social isolation and loneliness are associated with a 29% increased risk of coronary heart disease and a 32% increased risk of stroke. The effect sizes are comparable to smoking and obesity, so when we talk about buildings that discourage social connection, we're talking about a public health issue.
That's a striking statistic. So Daniel's landlord who cancels a lease to chase Airbnb revenue isn't just making one family move. They're contributing to a pattern that has measurable health consequences across the population.
That's why housing policy is health policy. It's why the German and Austrian and Singaporean models aren't just about being nice to tenants. They're about producing better health outcomes, lower crime, higher social trust, all the things that make a society functional.
Let's circle back to Israel specifically. What would it actually take to reform the Israeli rental market in the direction of Germany or Austria? Is there any political momentum for that?
There have been attempts. In 2017, a comprehensive rental reform bill was introduced in the Knesset. It proposed extending the standard lease to 3 years, capping annual rent increases at 2%, and requiring landlords to provide justification for eviction. It didn't pass. The landlord lobby is powerful, and the political will hasn't materialized. More recently, in 2023, there was a push for a rental registry and some basic protections, but it got bogged down in committee.
The landlord lobby argument is always the same. If you regulate, supply will dry up, investors will put their money elsewhere, and in a country with a housing shortage as severe as Israel's, that argument lands.
It lands politically, but the evidence from Germany and Austria doesn't really support it. Germany has strong tenant protections and a large, functioning rental market. About 54% of Germans rent, compared to about 28% in Israel. The rental market hasn't collapsed. Investors haven't fled. What happened is that the investment model adapted. In Germany, rental housing is seen as a long-term, stable, low-risk investment. Pension funds and institutional investors hold large portfolios of rental apartments. They're not looking for quick flips or Airbnb windfalls. They're looking for steady, predictable returns over decades.
The investor profile changes. Instead of small-time landlords who own one or two apartments and treat them like a side hustle, you get professional property management companies that can handle maintenance efficiently and have a reputational incentive to treat tenants fairly.
That's actually more efficient economically. A professional landlord with 1,000 units can spread maintenance costs, can invest in energy efficiency upgrades that pay off over 20 years, can hire dedicated staff. A small landlord with 2 units is often undercapitalized, does the bare minimum on maintenance, and sees the apartment as their retirement fund, which makes them emotionally reactive to any perceived threat to the asset.
Daniel described a landlord who lashed out over a leak issue and canceled the contract. That's exactly the small landlord emotional reactivity you're describing. A professional property manager would just fix the leak. It's a maintenance issue, not a personal betrayal.
The leak issue is actually a perfect microcosm of the dysfunction. In a well-regulated market, maintenance responsibilities are clearly delineated. The landlord is responsible for the building envelope and major systems. The tenant is responsible for minor upkeep. If a pipe bursts, there's no ambiguity about who pays and who fixes it. In Israel, it's often a negotiation, and the tenant has very little leverage.
Because the ultimate leverage the landlord has is, I just won't renew your lease. And in a 12-month cycle, that threat is always looming.
Which brings us to the psychological dimension Daniel was so honest about. He said he's adopted a callous approach to neighborly relations. He's not proud of it, but he's rationalized it. And his reasoning is sound given the constraints. Why invest emotionally in a relationship that has an expiration date you don't control?
It's the same logic that makes people reluctant to form close friendships in their last year of university, or in a temporary job posting. The difference is that for Daniel, and for millions of renters in unregulated markets, the temporary condition is permanent. It's not a phase. It's the structure of their life.
That has generational effects. If you're raising a child in a series of 12-month rentals, that child doesn't have a stable neighborhood. They don't have the experience of growing up with the same kids on the same block. They don't have the continuity that builds social skills and a sense of belonging. Daniel mentioned his son Ezra. Ezra's experience of home is fundamentally different from what Daniel had growing up in a detached house in Ireland.
Daniel grew up in a detached house in Ireland where the default was stability. You knew your neighbors because they'd been there for 20 years and would be there for 20 more. Moving to Israel and living in a dozen apartments in a decade is a complete inversion of that. And he's asking essentially, how do you build a life on shifting sand?
The answer, from looking at the countries that have done this well, is that you don't. You change the sand. You create legal structures that make the ground solid. And then the community grows naturally because the conditions are right for it.
There's a quote from a housing researcher named Peter Marcuse. He said that housing is not just shelter. It's the physical anchor for every other aspect of life. Your job, your relationships, your health, your children's education, they all radiate out from where you live. If your housing is unstable, everything else becomes unstable too.
Marcuse wrote extensively on this. He distinguished between housing as a commodity and housing as a right. And he argued that treating housing purely as a commodity inevitably produces the kind of precarity Daniel is experiencing. The commodity logic says, if someone will pay more for this apartment than you will, you're out. The rights-based logic says, your need for stable shelter outweighs the landlord's desire for marginally higher returns.
The commodity logic has been winning globally for decades. Financialization of housing, the rise of Airbnb, the treatment of apartments as assets rather than homes. But the counterexamples we've discussed, Germany, Austria, Singapore, show that it doesn't have to be this way. There are functioning alternatives.
Singapore is particularly instructive because it's not a socialist country. It's aggressively capitalist in most respects. But on housing, it made a conscious decision in the 1960s that the market alone wouldn't provide decent housing for the population, so the state would step in. And it worked. It created a nation of homeowners with a stake in their communities.
The HDB model also addresses something Daniel didn't explicitly mention but is implicit in his prompt. The class dimension. He said that in Israel, even what might be considered wealthy people elsewhere are forced into smaller living arrangements, and generously spaced apartments are only for the ultra-wealthy. When housing is purely market-driven, space becomes a luxury good. In Singapore, the HDB flats are modest but functional, and they're available to the vast majority of the population. The ultra-wealthy can buy private condos if they want, but the baseline for everyone else is decent.
Vienna does the same thing. The social housing is not just for the poor, it's for the broad middle. And because so much of the housing stock is outside the speculative market, the private market is also more restrained. Landlords have to compete with the municipal housing, which keeps private rents lower than they would be otherwise.
The competition argument is an interesting one. In Israel, there's no public housing to speak of, not at scale. The government got out of the housing business decades ago, so private landlords have a captive market. They can charge whatever the market will bear, and the market will bear a lot because the alternative is homelessness.
Israel's public housing stock is about 2% of the total housing units. In Vienna, it's over 40%. In Singapore, it's 80%. The difference in tenant power that results from those numbers is hard to overstate.
If Daniel were to take one actionable insight from this conversation, it might be that his experience is not a personal failure. It's a structural outcome. He's been a good tenant in a bad system. And the system is bad not because of a few bad landlords, though those exist, but because the rules of the game are designed to produce instability.
The instability produces exactly the atomization he's describing. People who don't know their neighbors. People who don't join building committees. People who don't intervene when something's wrong. It's not that Israelis are uniquely unfriendly. It's that the rental market selects for transience, and transience selects for disengagement.
There's a researcher named Robert Putnam who wrote about social capital. Bowling Alone was his famous book. He documented the decline of community organizations in America. One of the factors he identified was residential mobility. When people move frequently, they don't put down roots. They don't join things. The social capital erodes.
Putnam's work is directly relevant here. He found that each additional year of residential stability in a community predicted higher levels of civic engagement, higher voter turnout, higher levels of trust. The effect was linear. Every year matters. So when you have a rental market that churns tenants every 12 months, you're systematically destroying social capital.
Daniel's point about the security situation adds another layer. In a country that faces periodic military threats, social capital isn't just nice. It's a component of civil defense. The Homefront Command in Israel actually encourages building committees and neighborhood preparedness plans. But those plans require continuity. They require people who know each other and know the building.
I've seen this firsthand. During the conflicts, the buildings that had strong tenant networks were more resilient. People knew who needed help. They shared resources. The buildings that were anonymous, people were on their own. Same threat, totally different capacity to respond.
We've diagnosed the problem. Israel's rental market is an unregulated swamp, to use Daniel's phrase. The best practice models are Germany, Austria, and Singapore, which combine strong tenant protections, rent control mechanisms, and in the cases of Vienna and Singapore, massive public investment in housing. The outcomes are stability, community, and resilience. The barriers to reform in Israel are political, not technical.
I want to add one more model that's worth looking at, which is Hong Kong. Daniel mentioned it in his prompt. Hong Kong is fascinating because it's extremely dense, extremely expensive, and has a unique hybrid system. About 45% of the population lives in public rental housing or subsidized home ownership schemes. The public rental housing is managed by the Hong Kong Housing Authority. Rents are heavily subsidized, about 10% of household income on average, and the tenancy is essentially permanent as long as income limits aren't exceeded.
It means tested but stable.
And the density there is off the charts. The public housing estates are massive, sometimes 40 or 50 stories, thousands of units in a single complex. And yet, there's a strong sense of community in many of these estates. The Housing Authority has estate management advisory committees that include tenant representatives. There are community centers, markets, schools integrated into the developments. It's not idyllic. There are real problems with maintenance and aging infrastructure, but the stability is there.
The stability being the prerequisite for everything else.
The Hong Kong case shows that even in an extreme density environment, if people know they're not going to be displaced, they build communities. They form neighborhood watches. They run mahjong groups. They look after each other's kids. Human beings are social animals. We'll form communities in almost any conditions, as long as we're not constantly being uprooted.
Daniel's prompt had a kind of weary tone to it. 10 years of this, and he's tired. And I think a lot of listeners, especially in markets like Israel or the more expensive American cities, will recognize that weariness. The sense that you're doing everything right and still losing.
His question about whether it's worth investing in neighborly relationships, I think the answer from the research is, yes, it is worth it, but it's harder than it should be. The system is working against you. And recognizing that is important because it prevents you from internalizing the failure. You're not bad at being a neighbor. The structure makes neighboring irrational.
The structure makes neighboring irrational. If you change the structure, you change the incentives, and the behavior follows.
There's a final point I want to make about Airbnb, because Daniel raised it and it connects to the broader theme. In cities that have cracked down on short-term rentals, the effects on housing supply have been measurable. A study from the University of California looked at the impact of Airbnb regulations in San Francisco. They found that after the city implemented strict registration requirements and a 90-day cap, the number of entire home listings dropped by about 50%, and the long-term rental supply increased by an estimated 3 to 5%. It's not a silver bullet, but it's a meaningful effect.
3 to 5% might not sound like much, but in a tight market, that's thousands of units that were being used as unlicensed hotels going back to being homes for actual residents. and every unit that goes back to long-term rental is a unit where someone can put down roots.
Every long-term resident is a potential member of the building ecosystem. Someone who might join the committee, might organize the WhatsApp group, might check on the elderly neighbor. The social return on that unit is much higher than the financial return to the landlord from short-term rentals.
The policy prescription is fairly clear. Strong tenant protections, indefinite leases with defined eviction grounds, rent control mechanisms tied to transparent indices, large-scale public or social housing investment, and strict regulation of short-term rentals. Countries that do all of these things have functional rental markets and strong communities. Countries that do none of them have what Daniel described.
The political challenge is real. Landlords are organized and motivated. Tenants are diffuse and often don't realize their common interest until they've been burned. But the examples we've discussed show that reform is possible. Germany's tenant protections weren't handed down from on high. They were fought for over decades by tenant movements and political coalitions.
Vienna's municipal housing was the product of the Red Vienna movement in the 1920s, when the Social Democrats won control of the city and embarked on an ambitious building program. It was explicitly ideological. They believed housing was a right, and they built accordingly. A century later, the results speak for themselves.
Singapore's HDB was a top-down project by Lee Kuan Yew's government. It wasn't democratic in the grassroots sense, but it was effective. Differed paths to similar outcomes. Stable housing, stable communities, better lives.
Daniel, if you're listening, the short answer to your question is no, you're not crazy. The system is broken. And yes, there are places where it works better. The long answer is, we need to build the political will to fix it here. And that starts with people recognizing that their individual housing horror stories are not just bad luck, they're symptoms of a structural failure.
In the meantime, even within a broken system, the impulse to connect with neighbors is not foolish, it's human. The built-in WhatsApp group, the casual conversation in the elevator, the offer to help with a broken router, these things matter. They're acts of resistance against the atomization the market wants to impose.
All right, let's wrap this up with Hilbert's daily fun fact.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
The male seahorse gives birth to live young after the female deposits eggs into his brood pouch. A single pregnancy can produce up to 2,000 babies.
2,000 babies. And I thought my family gatherings were crowded.
Nature is deeply strange. Thank you, Hilbert. That was produced by Hilbert Flumingtop. This has been My Weird Prompts. If you want more episodes, find us at myweirdprompts.com or on Spotify. We're back next time.
Take care, everyone.
This episode was generated using Gemini Flash 3. Text-to-speech engine was Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth's slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep, the stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close, from sloth, from man, from long ear. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.